to hostile offer for CNW Corporation, the railroad's publicly traded parent, after buying up nearly 9% of CNW's shares in the open market. Immediately after catching wind of Japonica's move, CNW Chief Executive Robert Schmiga reached out to potential investors he thought would be friendly toward management to see if they'd be willing to trump Japonica's $44 a share bid. Both Blackstone and DLJ expressed interest, and at Schmiga's suggestion, they pooled forces and started crafting a joint offer. Soon after, a third potential co-investor surfaced, Union Pacific Railroad, the nation's third-largest railroad. UP, whose tracks from the West Coast ended at Omaha, had long coveted CNW, whose lines ran from there to Chicago, the nation's rail hub, and the connection to Eastern lines. UP's chairman, Drew Lewis, transportation secretary in the Reagan administration, and an old friend of Peterson's, called Peterson and said UP wanted in. UP was the obvious ultimate owner of CNW, but under federal rules it could not buy more than 25% without obtaining regulatory approval, a process that could stretch on for years. UP collaborated with CNW on shipments to and from the East, and Lewis was horrified at the thought of CNW's falling into Japonica's hands, fearing that the raider would slash upkeep and hurt service. The Federal Railroad merger rules prevented UP from topping Japonica's offer. Taking a stake in a Blackstone buyout of CNW would serve UP's purposes nicely. I asked Lewis, "What would you do if you owned it?" Peterson says. Lewis said that CNW's rail beds hadn't been upgraded and that UP wanted to be able to run trains at up to 55 miles per hour. So we said, "Why don't we make that rail bed investment part of the deal?" Lewis also requested that CNW hand off to UP some of its highly lucrative business hauling low-sulfur coal from mines in Wyoming's Powder River Basin. We told him that if his prices were competitive, that would be fine with us, says Peterson. Together, Blackstone, DLJ, and UP put up a $45.50 per share offer on the table, and on June 6th, Japonica dropped out, collecting a nice profit as the shares rose during the bidding, illustrating again that in the corporate raider game, you can win by losing. Although the $1.6 billion price was rich, Blackstone was paying 8 times cash flow, twice what it had paid for Transtar. It was risking comparatively little. Blackstone injected $75 million of equity for a 72% ownership stake, while DLJ's buyout arm put in $25 million for 24%. Union Pacific invested $100 million in preferred stock that paid a dividend. Though the preferred didn't have the potential to rise or fall in value like common stock, UP had an option to convert it after 5 years into common shares for 25% ownership. Lenders led by Chemical Bank and DLJ's investment banking operation furnished most of the remaining $1.4 billion. On June 23rd, the buyout, Blackstone's fourth, was put to bed. But not to rest. 3 months later, a nightmare set in. In the intervening months, lenders and bond investors became nervous that the market had overheated, and the trading prices of junk bonds tumbled as investors ran for the hills. As in the financial crisis 2 decades later, credit suddenly tightened. Leverage wasn't just out of fashion. It had become next to impossible to obtain. Indeed, the whole financing apparatus that had given rise to leveraged buyouts was sputtering, and the CNW deal looked like it might die along with it. The problem was a $475 million bridge loan DLJ had provided to finance the deal until CNW could arrange to float new bonds. Bridge financing had been invented to compete with Drexel's junk bonds. The process of issuing bonds was cumbersome and could take months. Elaborate prospectuses had to be prepared and circulated, and buyers had to be lined up. Drexel was so adept at hawking junk, however, that companies and other banks involved in a deal would go forward with a takeover based solely on Drexel's assurance that it was highly confident it could sell the necessary bonds. Other banks couldn't do that, so instead they offered short-term loans that allowed the buyer to close the deal immediately and issue bonds later to repay the bridge loans. In 1988, DLJ, Merrill Lynch, and First Boston had each nibbled away at Drexel's market share in leveraged takeovers this way. But bridge lending was risky for the banks because they could end up stuck with inventories of large and wobbly loans if the market changed direction, or the company stumbled between the time the deal was signed up and the marketing of the bonds. The peril was magnified because bridge loans bore high junk bond-like interest rates, which ratcheted up to punishing levels if borrowers failed to retire the loans on schedule. The ratchets were meant to prod bridge owners to refinance quickly with junk, and up until the fall of 1989, every bridge loan issued by a major investment bank had been repaid. But the ratchets began to work against the banks when the credit markets turned that fall. The rates shot so high that the borrowers couldn't afford them, and the banks found themselves stuck with loans that were headed toward default. The perils of bridge lending hit home that September and October when Robert Campo, a Canadian financier and real estate developer, struggled valiantly to refinance a $400 million bridge loan he had taken out the year before, with First Boston and two other banks, to buy Federated Department Stores, the parent of Bloomingdale's, Abraham & Strauss, Filene's, and Lazarus Stores. After the abrupt failure of the $6.8 billion United Airlines buyout on October 13th, the leveraged finance business all but ceased. Campo couldn't arrange borrowings to pay back the bridge, and Federated filed for bankruptcy. First Boston came close to toppling that year because of its loan to Campo and two other bridge loans it made for a takeover of the Long John Silver's restaurant chain and for a buyout of Ohio Mattress Company, the parent of Sealy. The Ohio Mattress debacle was quickly dubbed the Burning Bed, and remains, along with Campo, a pivotal episode in takeover lore. DLJ found itself in similarly precarious straits. It had planned to market CNW bonds to refinance the CNW bridge loan the third week of October 1989, but the United employee buyout cratered the week before and spooked the markets. DLJ now was saddled with two enormous bridge loans, the $475 million one for CNW and a $500 million loan to TW Services, owner of the Denny's restaurant chain. Some of the money had been furnished by other institutions, but the bulk had come from DLJ and its corporate parent, Equitable Life. DLJ's very survival now hinged on its bond desk's ability to peddle CNW and TW Services bonds at a time when investors were scared to bet on highly leveraged companies. To no one's surprise, bond buyers demanded much higher interest rates than DLJ had bargained for, and much higher rates than CNW had expected to pay. So it was that one dark, blustery morning in mid-October, Schwartzman trekked downtown to DLJ's headquarters across from the World Trade Center to hash out the terms for the bonds. The senior banker on DLJ's side of the table was Hamilton Tony James, who was the boss of both DLJ's buyout group and its junk bond sales force. 38 years old, he was composed under fire, and many who have worked for him attest ferociously intelligent. In addition to creating and running the bank's LBO and junk units, he led M&A and restructuring. Ostensibly the number three executive, he was considered by many inside and outside the bank to be its de facto chief executive. Their tense face-off that morning was the first time that James, who years later would become Blackstone's president and chief operating officer, had met Schwartzman. Failing to refinance the bridge would be calamitous for DLJ and Blackstone alike. It would leave DLJ holding a giant risky debt that it never expected to keep, and it would slam CNW with escalating interest payments that could sink the company and obliterate Blackstone's equity. But James and Schwartzman had different ideas about how to solve the problem. DLJ was so desperate to get the bridge loan paid off that it was willing to offer bond buyers the moon. Blackstone, by contrast, was fixated on protecting its equity investment and didn't want to endanger CNW with sky-high rates. DLJ was scared silly. There was fear in the room, Schwartzman says. After some heated give-and-take, they reached a middle ground, with Blackstone agreeing to raise the rate on the junk bonds from 14.5%, already very high, to 14.75%, and to award bond buyers a 10% equity share in CNW as well. But James and his team wanted yet another inducement for bond buyers, an offer to raise the interest rate on the bonds after a year if the bonds had declined in value. It was known as a reset clause, and as the junk bond market turned increasingly jittery, investors had begun to insist on resets to limit their risk. DLJ demanded that one be added to the CNW package. Reset notes were akin to adjustable-rate home mortgages, but instead of being tied to a broad index of borrowing costs, as adjustable mortgages typically are, the rates on reset notes are adjusted to reflect the going market value of the notes or bonds themselves. Suppose investors buy $1,000 bonds that pay $147.50, or 14.75% annual interest, and the bond's market value falls to $970 a year later, because interest rates in general have risen, making the old 14.75% bonds less desirable, or because the particular company is in trouble. The fall in value means that for an investor who buys them at $970, the bonds effectively are paying 15.2% interest. The reset clause would restore the bonds to their face value. To make up for the drop in price, the company would be required to boost the interest 3% to $152 a year, returning the bond's market value to $1,000, making the original bond buyers whole and happy. As hard as DLJ pushed for a reset, Schwartzman pushed back just as hard. What if the bonds traded down to 90 cents on the dollar, triggering a rate hike to 16.4%? The market was capricious and Schwartzman was leery of open-ended risks. I said, "I'm not doing a reset. I have to know my cost of money. What if there's a bad economy? You could bankrupt the company." This was terrible corporate finance. But DLJ said, "We need a reset or we won't do the deal." Eventually, Schwartzman said he could agree to a reset, provided that there was a 15.5% cap on the adjusted rate. After a back and forth, James agreed. The DLJ bankers insisted that the odds were strongly against the bonds falling so much in value that CNW would have to pay 15.5%. Schwartzman worried, though, that someone would figure out how to depress the bond price temporarily near the reset date, so the new rate would hit the cap. A trader buying the bond then at a discount could make a killing when the interest rate was reset. I said that somehow some trader will find a way to make sure the bonds reset at the top of the cap, Schwartzman recalls. I said, I'll personally bet you $100,000 it will reset at the top. There was stunned silence. Nobody is good for $100,000. What about $50,000? Again, silence. How about $25,000? Finally, Tony James bet $5,000. James, too, recalls the exchange vividly. We went back and forth a long time. This was the last issue we got hung up on. We couldn't get Steve off it. Eventually, I said, all right, Steve, I'll bet you $5,000 this gets reset below the cap. Asked if the wager started at $100,000 and descended in increments, James responds, I'm going with my version. The reset still wasn't enough to sell all the bonds, and DLJ was stuck holding a lot of them in its own account, as well as a big slug of TW Services bonds. With DLJ still struggling, many employees received unsold CNW and TW bonds in lieu of cash bonuses that year. But DLJ staved off bankruptcy. As for the reset, Schwartzman's prediction was borne out. CNW's bonds fell sharply, sending the interest rate up to 15.5%. Steve won the money because the market continued to deteriorate, says James. He was gracious and had me give the money to charity. The seize-up of the markets and the turmoil that followed the downfall of the Campo, Federated, and United Airlines deals foreshadowed the credit crisis the financial world experienced a generation later. Though the downturn that began in 2007 lasted longer and inflicted far wider damage than that of the early 1990s, no major commercial or investment banks foundered in the early 90s, as Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers did in 2008, both shared a root cause, over-exuberant borrowing. In both cases, scores of lending institutions went under, and buyout firms strained to keep debt-laden holdings afloat. Then, as later, buyout players that had binged on leverage would have a nasty hangover. Within months of the Federated and United problems, the biggest LBO ever, the deal that had come to symbolize the buyout business, was teetering on the verge of collapse. KKR's buyout of RJR Nabisco, the tobacco and food giant that peddled Oreo cookies, Ritz crackers, and Winston and Salem cigarettes, embodied the raucous, rapacious ethos of the late 1980s. It had everything. An imperial CEO who maintained a fleet of 10 corporate jets, doled out $1,500 Gucci watches to employees, and surrounded himself with celebrities at company-funded golf events, Wall Street sharks circling the prey, and a teeming supporting cast of bankers and lawyers craving a cut. It was a tale of greed, excess, and hubris, with no small measure of farce. In the words of M&A banker Bruce Wasserstein, it was the roller derby of deals. It began in October 1988 with the CEO, F. Ross Johnson, who was frustrated that RJR's stock wouldn't budge, even though profits were up, lodging a bid. That month, with backing from Peter Cohen at Shearson Lehman Hutton, Johnson won his board's support for a $75 a share management-led buyout. Management would put up equity and would borrow the balance. His bid, one-third higher than RJR's stock price, was far from stingy. But Johnson saw value in a company that could not win the stock market's love. He calculated that if they bought at the right price, he and his financial backers could all make a fortune selling pieces of the business, capturing the hidden value for themselves. For Cohen, the deal was a chance to resuscitate the M&A franchise Shearson had acquired with Lehman. But Johnson and Cohen quickly lost control of the situation and of Johnson's company. Henry Kravis and George Roberts thought Johnson had made a low-ball bid. Some outsiders figured that RJR could be worth as much as $100 a share if it were split up, and Kravis and Roberts calculated that they could top Johnson's offer and still make a bundle by shedding parts of RJR and slashing fat. KKR decided to crash Johnson's party, bypassing him and RJR's board with a $90 per share tender offer aimed directly at shareholders. The sidewalk fisticuffs soon became a full-blown rumble. Ted Forsman allied himself with Johnson, offering to help save the company from the clutches of Kravis, Forsman's nemesis. Most of Wall Street lined up on one side or the other with offers of financing. But it was all over. 6 weeks after it began, KKR had been forced to raise its offer to $109 per share, which the board accepted over a $112 bid from Johnson. Both bids offered shareholders a mix of cash and promissory notes, short-term bonds in effect, but KKR's terms on its notes were more generous. By then, Johnson had been publicly pilloried, both for the rich golden parachute package he had negotiated, so he would be paid millions if he were deposed after a takeover, and for trying to buy his company from his own shareholders at an unfairly low price. In this winner-take-all game, Johnson found himself without a job, and Cohen, his dreams of ascendancy dashed, resigned as chairman of Shearson Lehman in January 1990. The takeover was the defining moment of the buyout industry. From the opening skirmish, it was seen for what it was, a battle between corporate America and a new breed of Wall Street titan. The firm's partners each take home in the neighborhood of $50 million a year, according to people close to the firm. The New York Times gushed when KKR made its opening bid, pointing out the $2 billion KKR had made breaking up Beatrice Foods over the preceding years. More significant in the long term, KKR emerged from the RJR battle perceived as a raider. Technically, KKR's was not a hostile bid. In Wall Street parlance, a hostile bid is one made at a time when the company has not put itself up for sale, and KKR came in only after RJR's board had put the company in play by entertaining Johnson's offer. But that was a legalism. The fact was that KKR had bid against the management and won. It had snatched control away from the CEO and now promised to slash costs and carve up the company. To the man on the street, that was no different from what corporate raiders did. At $31.3 billion, the RJR buyout smashed all records. It was more than three times the size of the next biggest, KKR's $8.7 billion LBO of Beatrice in 1986. But KKR ended up paying a dangerously high 11 times cash flow, and there was a time bomb buried in the complicated mix of debt behind the buyout. $6 billion of reset notes whose interest rates were up for adjustment in February 1991. Like the CNW reset notes that had alarmed Schwartzman when Blackstone was arranging debt for that deal in October 1989, the interest on the RJR notes had to be readjusted upward if the notes traded below their face value. But unlike the CNW notes, where Schwartzman had insisted there be a ceiling on the maximum interest rate, the RJR reset notes had no limit on rates. RJR would have to pay whatever rate it took to restore the bonds to their original value so bondholders wouldn't suffer a loss. With the investors fleeing risky securities, interest rates spiked, and the notes were trading at such deeply depressed prices that RJR faced the prospect that the rate on the notes might jump from 13.71% to 25%. The hit would be lethal, adding more than $670 million in yearly interest costs that RJR could in no way afford. By the spring of 1990, the situation was grave enough that Martin Lipton, a famed takeover attorney, warned Henry Kravis that Chapter 11 might be RJR's only option. "There's no way we'd do that," Kravis retorted. If the company defaulted, KKR stood to lose its entire $1.5 billion of equity. In July, KKR did the only thing it could do to stave off bankruptcy. It doubled down, investing another $1.7 billion of equity to bail out RJR as part of a debt refinancing. RJR managed to fend off insolvency, but the investment came to be seen not as a triumph, but as the all-time booby prize, Exhibit A, in the case against the LBO. The rip-roaring bestseller, Barbarians at the Gate, by Wall Street Journal reporters Brian Burrow and John Hellyer, released in 1990, cemented the deal's reputation as a monument to twisted thinking, greed, and megalomania. Years later, when KKR finally extricated itself from the last of its investment, it had lost more than $700 million. Investors in KKR's record $6.1 billion 1987 fund ended up with a mediocre 9% return after KKR collected its cut. A devastating front-page story in the Wall Street Journal that year completed the picture of KKR and the buyout business from another angle. The lengthy piece about KKR's 1986 buyout of Safeway by Susan Faludi focused not on jousting executives and financiers, but on the rank-and-file employees who lived through the buyout of the supermarket chain and the layoffs and divestitures that followed. The story was awarded a Pulitzer Prize the next year for revealing the human costs of high finance. It was an ugly picture, the journal painted. KKR and Safeway's management made four times their money when the chain went public again in 1990. Employees, on the other hand, have considerably less reason to celebrate. 63,000 managers and workers were cut loose from Safeway through store sales or layoffs. A survey of former Safeway employees in Dallas found that nearly 60% still hadn't found full-time employment more than a year after the layoff. James White, a Safeway trucker for nearly 30 years in Dallas, was among the 60%. In 1988, he marked the one-year anniversary of his last shift at Safeway this way. First, he told his wife he loved her. Then he locked the bathroom door, loaded his .22-caliber hunting rifle, and blew his brains out. The new management philosophy was poetically summed up in the change in the company's motto from "Safeway offers security" to "targeted returns on current investment." Coming the same year as Barbarians, the story helped crystallize the reputation of buyout moguls as ruthless job cutters who looted companies of cash and assets for the sake of short-term profits. It was not just the layoffs that made the Safeway buyout emblematic of the 80s. The Safeway saga had all the ingredients of a classic LBO of its era. The deal emerged after a father and son team of raiders began circling the chain, which they viewed as a lumbering business run by complacent managers who didn't appreciate the company's undervalued, underutilized assets. There was a bidding war, and the company emerged with debt heaped upon it. The true consequences of the Safeway buyout, however, were rather different from what the journal portrayed. The first 3 years under KKR were indeed tumultuous as Safeway shrank its business by 30% and sold 40% of its stores. Tens of thousands of employees did pay a steep price, but KKR reshaped a languishing company and positioned it to thrive in the next decade. In that way, it was a case study in the economic payoff from the upheaval and restructuring wrought by the raiders and buyout firms. Safeway may have been a company legendary for job security, as the journal said, but that was another way of saying that it had become bloated. Its labor costs had shot up and were a third higher than those of its competitors, most of which were also unionized, because Safeway had been preoccupied with expansion rather than profitability. Management had been virtually hereditary. Safeway's CEO at the time, Peter McGowan, had succeeded his father at age 37, and his grandfather, Charles Merrill, a founder of Merrill Lynch, had been instrumental in assembling the chain through mergers in the 1920s and 30s as an investor, a banker, and later as head of the company. Safeway had a strong brand in its home market in Northern California, as well as the Pacific Northwest and Washington, D.C., but was competing ineffectively and losing money in many others. Moreover, it did not even have internal mechanisms to gauge the profitability of its divisions or its investments. In 1986, Herbert and Robert Haft, two sometime corporate raiders whose family had owned the dark drug chain, thought they could do a better job running Safeway and began buying up the stock as a prelude to a hostile takeover bid. In July, after amassing a 6% stake, they went directly to shareholders with a $58 a share bid, backed with a promise from Drexel to provide billions in financing. KKR had already been eyeing Safeway, but McGowan had brushed off several feelers from the firm. Now, with his job threatened, he was receptive when KKR offered to be a white knight, allying with management to take the company private. Soon, KKR and McGowan had formulated a $4.8 billion, $69 a share offer, which Safeway's board recommended to shareholders when the Hafts refused to up their bid beyond $64. KKR would put up $132 million of equity for about a 90% ownership interest, with management taking a 10% stake. Morgan Stanley and Bankers Trust backed KKR's bid since Drexel was spoken for. The Hafts were outbid, but walked away with a $153 million profit, double the money they'd spent buying Safeway stock, including millions Safeway paid to settle a lawsuit over its defensive tactics during the battle. Other shareholders did well, too, for KKR's offer was 70% above the stock's price when the Hafts began buying up shares. While KKR kept McGowan on as CEO, he would now be playing according to KKR's script as Kravis Roberts and their partners put Safeway through radical reconstructive surgery. Lowering labor costs was only one piece of KKR's strategy. Equally important was getting out of markets where Safeway was an also-ran. Safeway quickly sold off its Los Angeles and San Diego stores, where it had small market shares, to stronger competitors. Soon its Salt Lake City, Arkansas, Oklahoma City, and Kansas City stores were offloaded, also to other chains. Out went the profitable British subsidiary, sold to reduce debt. Meanwhile, a British wine retailer that wanted to branch into the United States bought Safeway's struggling liquor barn operation. What made Safeway so ripe for an LBO was the fact that it had never scrutinized how it used its capital, whether its investments were paying off or where it was making and losing money. KKR set to work at once analyzing Safeway's real estate to determine which properties were so marginal as grocery stores that the company was better off disposing of them. The test was not what the company had paid for properties years before, but what they were worth today. That was the real measure of the capital tied up in the property, and viewed that way, many of the stores didn't pass muster. Those were sold off. Headquarters staff, meanwhile, was slashed 20%, and managers down through the ranks were given new financial incentives to increase profitability and returns on investment, rather than just to increase sales at whatever cost, as they had in the past. At a time when no-frills warehouse stores were gaining big market shares with their low prices, Safeway's labor costs put it at a tremendous competitive disadvantage. Its rank-and-file workers thus inevitably bore the brunt of cost-cutting at the stores Safeway retained. The company succeeded in renegotiating terms with its unions in most regions, cutting wages for tens of thousands of employees. In the Dallas area, however, where Safeway's competitors were not unionized, Safeway's unions demanded that Safeway sell its stores to a unionized company and refused to grant concessions when their contracts expired. Without some break on labor costs, Safeway said it would not be able to find a buyer for the stores as a unit, and it opted to shut 131 stores and sold them piecemeal, mainly to smaller, non-unionized chains. Some 8,600 employees, mostly union members, were let go. The slashing cut plenty of muscle with the fat, both from Safeway's holdings and from its labor force, and deferred capital improvements in favor of the all-consuming debt, the Journal declared in its 1990 piece. But Safeway's growth in the 90s disproved that. When the restructuring was complete, Safeway had contracted from 2,400 to 1,400 stores, and from $20 billion in sales to $14 billion, a shrinking act that would have been virtually unthinkable for a public company to attempt, because stockholders and investment analysts would never tolerate the risks. Yet remarkably, cash flow rose 250% during the coming decade. Capital spending, which had been cut in half from 1987 to 1989 during the divestiture program, was restored in 1990 after Safeway's debt had been reduced and the company set out on a new expansion, this time targeting profitable markets. The full history of the Safeway buyout actually debunks many of the clichés about LBOs. Yes, there were big job and pay reductions, but the company's workforce remained 90% unionized, and the asset sales, cuts, and new incentives had a dramatic impact on Safeway's profitability, which had lagged for years. By 1989, 3 years after the buyout, the chain's operating profit margin, which had been 2.2% in 1985, was up almost one-half to 3.2%. Far from hamstringing the company, the brutal pruning of Safeway laid the foundation for an extraordinary run after the company went public in 1990. After a brief dip in the early 90s, Safeway's stock skyrocketed more than 20 times in value, going from $2.81 at its IPO in 1990, adjusted for stock splits, to $62 by 2000, the year KKR sold the last of its stake. The buyout had been leveraged in the extreme, with just 3% equity, so the payoff was huge. KKR made more than 50 times its money. The deal also flew in the face of the notion that buyout firms seek quick flips. Despite its big profit early on, KKR retained a stake in Safeway for nearly 14 years. The strategy behind KKR's restructuring of Safeway was not unique to buyout firms. Spurred by new business school teachings about measuring returns on capital, executives and boards of directors were increasingly re-examining their businesses. If we sold this factory, could we reinvest the money and make a higher return than we do now? Would we be better to focus on the fastest-growing and most profitable parts of our company? Could we raise money to invest in them by selling off other subsidiaries? These were the same questions people like Kravis and Roberts had been asking as they sized up investments. The pressure exerted by the enormous debt loads on companies that had undergone LBOs accelerated the process greatly. But the same relentless, unsentimental re-examination of companies by their managers was becoming the norm throughout the American corporate world. Boards and CEOs knew full well that if they didn't perform the analyses and make the changes, someone else might take over their company, sack them, and do it themselves. A decade of looking over their shoulders at the Raiders and the buyout firms, enabled by Drexel's debt, had brought that lesson home emphatically. These people were very influential, says Robert Bruner, the dean of the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. Not only did they help unlock resources and displace sleepy managements, he says, but the buyouts wave and the Raiders really liberalized the way we look at the generation of value by companies and the delivery of that value. It was the beginning of a new age in market capitalism, one with constant upheaval and less security for executives and workers alike. But it instilled a discipline and incited a new drive for efficiency with payoffs for the economy as a whole, so much so that it permanently reshaped the thinking of public company managers. No longer were the public stock markets populated with scores of companies worth less as a whole than the sum of their parts. As managers worked to eliminate that disparity, there were fewer and fewer easy pickings for the Raiders and buyout firms. Financing takeovers also grew harder. When the credit markets finally opened back up in the early 90s, lenders demanded that buyers front 20% or 30% or more of the entire price in equity, not 5% to 10% as in the 1980s. That sidelined many Raiders who had drawn sustenance from Drexel and typically did not have big pools of equity themselves. In the 1990s, Raiders largely ceased to be a force. For buyout firms, the game had to change as well. No longer could they lean so heavily on the power of leverage to deliver gains or simply break apart what they'd bought. Now they would have to take companies more or less as they were and burrow deeper into the nitty-gritty of their operations to make them worth more. Value creation would be the new mantra. Chapter 9. Fresh Faces. R.J.R. Nabisco and other LBOs were not the only victims of the debt crisis that set in at the end of 1989. From KKR's Midtown Manhattan office to Drexel's posh Beverly Hills digs and small-town savings and loans across the Sun Belt, credit was suddenly in short supply. The Drexel junk bond operation had been operating under a cloud since late 1986, when news surfaced that the Securities and Exchange Commission had begun an insider trading investigation of Drexel and Michael Milken, who not only created the junk bond market, but had stabilized it through thick and thin. The bank pleaded guilty to criminal charges in December 1988 and agreed to pay a $650 million fine. Milken was indicted for his role in March 1989 and left Drexel. The impact was not immediate, but the elaborate set of relationships Milken had used to sustain the junk market and to rescue his clients when they stumbled and were in danger of defaulting, was being undermined. No more could a troubled company have faith that Milken would refinance its debt to keep it going. No longer was he there to call in favors, tapping one client to buy another's bonds, as he often did. The junk market had cooled in 1989, but that October it completely froze up. The precipitating event was the breakdown of the $6.8 billion employee-led buyout of United Airlines. When the senior lenders for that deal got cold feet, it spooked other banks, which in turn swore off LBOs. Across the board, investors began to take a new look at risks, and junk bonds were one of the riskiest forms of debt. It became nearly impossible to sell them. The turn in the market sank Drexel. With losses piling up, the bank filed for bankruptcy in February 1990, putting a nail in the high-yield coffin and punctuating the end of the era. The junk bond market, which had churned out $20 billion to $40 billion in new issues annually from 1986 to 1989, all but evaporated. In 1990, just $1.4 billion of new bonds were sold. At the same time, even larger problems were brewing far from the big city banks. The savings and loan industry, which had been deregulated in the early 80s, was melting down. SNLs had been instrumental in financing a decade-long real estate boom, and in a mix of incompetence, greed, and cronyism, they had used their deposits to make speculative loans. By the end of the decade, SNLs were going bust in droves. Federal regulators seized 185 in 1988, 327 in 1989. Real estate prices collapsed over wide swaths of the United States, where the SNLs had lent with abandon for new offices and sub-developments. Many of the SNLs had also fed at Drexel's trough, both issuing junk bonds and buying those of other Drexel clients. When they were taken over and their assets sold, there was that much less demand for the bonds. The credit lockdown and the recession that followed in 1991 and 1992 put an end to the lavishly leveraged big-ticket takeovers of the previous decade. Schwartzman embellishes only slightly when he likens DLJ's frenzied scramble to sell the CNW bonds in October 1989 to catching the last helicopter out of Vietnam. Nearly 3 years would pass before there would be another sizable junk bond-financed LBO, a $1.5 billion deal by KKR for the insurer American Ray, and then KKR had to invest 20% of the price in equity, far more than it had been accustomed to stumping up. Blackstone, too, had to lower its sights. While its first six deals had averaged $1.1 billion in size, the average from 1991 to 1995 fell to barely $300 million. Blackstone wouldn't attempt another deal on the scale of the $1.6 billion CNW deal until 1996. The financial meltdown soon worked a Darwinian thinning of the ranks of LBO firms, crippling some, eviscerating others. The partners of Gibbons Green Van Amerongen, a 20-year-old pioneer of the LBO, split up in a bitter squabble over who was to blame for a string of wipeouts. Adler and Shaken, another established boutique, flamed out after most of its half-dozen investments bombed, and its investors demanded to be released from their future funding commitments. Adler and Shaken's second $178 million fund also would be its last. Ken Miller, the former Merrill Lynch M&A wunderkind who entered the buyout field in 1988 with his new Lodestar group amid great fanfare, ended up funneling more than half his $300 million fund into one misguided investment, the 1989 purchase of KinderCare Learning Centers, a daycare center operator. When KinderCare collapsed 3 years later, obliterating most of Lodestar's equity, Ken Miller's brief heyday as a buyout artist was over. Wasserstein Perella, the other firm whose debut buyout fund in 1988 unleashed a blizzard of hype just as Blackstone's LBO business was getting underway, survived but was bloodied. Like Lodestar, it put too much of its money on one horse, risking and ultimately losing just over one-third of its $1.1 billion fund on a $3 billion buyout of England's Gateway supermarket chain in 1989. Though it wrung big profits from smaller bets, on the cosmetics supplier Maybelline and Pneumo Abex, a landing gear maker, Wasserstein Perella was indelibly tarnished by the Gateway debacle, and the firm, later renamed Wasserstein and Company, never raised a buyout fund as large as its first. The savage shakeout forever altered the industry's power structure. Never again would KKR lord it over the business to the degree it had in the 1980s. Merely by surviving and safeguarding its investors' money as more ballyhooed firms bombed out, Blackstone was positioned to compete on a more equal footing in the years ahead. The upheaval also set the stage for a new generation of players to come to the fore, some of whom had set up shop around the time Blackstone's buyout operation was launched. Four of the newcomers, along with KKR and Blackstone, became dominant players in the 1990s. In Washington, D.C., in 1987, David Rubenstein, a brusque former lawyer and top Carter administration official, and William Conway, a former CFO of MCI Communications, formed the Carlyle Group, which carved out a unique niche through its knowledge of government's ins and outs. Carlyle notched its first big score in GDE Systems, a defense electronics business it bought in 1992 and sold in 1996 for 8 times its money. Because it chalked up most of its other early successes in the defense and aerospace industries, it gained a reputation for Washington-centric deals, even though it soon branched abroad and to other sectors. In Texas, meanwhile, Tom Hicks, a charismatic dealmaker who'd earned a fortune on LBOs of soft drink makers Dr. Pepper and 7-Up, broke up with his longtime partner Robert Haas and raised a $250 million fund with a new partner, John Muse. In one of its early deals, Hicks, Muse & Company, the firm they formed in 1989, bought Morningstar, a perilously indebted Houston dairy. They injected $30 million of equity, shoring up its balance sheet, and took it public a little over a year later. From its quick flip, Hicks Muse milked more than a fourfold gain. Two of the biggest emerging stars, Leon Black and David Bonderman, stepped to the front of the pack a year or two later when the buyout business was shut down in the early 90s by demonstrating that they were shrewd opportunists who could seize on the crisis to buy up distressed businesses at fire sale prices. Black, a towering man with the intimidating bulk of a linebacker, had been one of Drexel's stars, rising by his mid-30s to head Drexel's M&A bankers. Based in Drexel's New York office, he had instigated a host of takeover campaigns, which he passed off to Michael Milken in Beverly Hills for financing. Black emerged unscathed by Drexel's scandals and collapse, and proved as adaptable as a chameleon. In 1991, with the economy at its worst and the junk bond market at its nadir, state regulators in California seized Executive Life Insurance Company, a prime customer of Drexel's that had gone under as its bond holdings shriveled in value. When the state liquidated the company, Black, backed by money from a French bank, swooped in with a winning bid and snared the insurer's $8 billion junk bond portfolio at less than 40 cents on the dollar. Black was perfectly situated to evaluate the bonds, for he had advised many of the companies behind them. When the economy revived, he unloaded the securities piece by piece for more than a $1 billion profit, earning him an enduring place in the top tier of vulture investors. Apollo Advisors, Black's new firm, later renamed Apollo Management and then Apollo Global Management, ultimately reaped more than $5.7 billion in gains on the $2.2 billion it raised from 1990 to 1992 from Executive Life and other distressed assets. Bonderman was another child of the takeover boom who nimbly shifted course. A brainy ex-litigator known for his unorthodox sartorial get-ups, he often pairs plaid sports shirts with wildly clashing ties. Bonderman had executed a string of profitable takeovers as chief investment strategist to the Texas financier Robert M. Bass. But it was his pivotal role in Bass's 1988 purchase of the country's largest failed SNL, American Savings Bank, that brought him wide notice as a vulture investor of the first order. Bass invested $400 million, most of it borrowed to buy American Savings. Less than a year later, with its bad debts handed over to the government, the thrift was solidly in the black. Bass would turn a five-fold gain on the investment. Bonderman and another Bass alumnus, James Coulter, followed that in 1993 by buying Continental Airlines Incorporated out of bankruptcy with $400 million they'd rounded up from wealthy investors and institutions. Bonderman and Coulter ultimately came away with nine times their money on Continental. By then, they and a San Francisco business consultant, William Price, had launched their own buyout firm, Texas Pacific Group, based in Fort Worth and San Francisco, and raised a $720 million debut fund in 1994. They quickly became known as top-flight contrarians and turnaround artists, who would take on financially and operationally hobbled companies most buyout firms wouldn't touch. Bonderman did not conform to the Wall Street mold. Even as a lawyer, he had deviated from the conventional corporate career path, living in the Middle East, where he learned Arabic and studied Islamic law, and later doing a stint in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Like Schwartzman, though, he had a flair for partying. 4 years before the Schwartzman bash, Bonderman held his own even grander 60th birthday, flying scores of friends to Las Vegas, where they were entertained by the Rolling Stones, John Mellencamp, and Robin Williams at the Hard Rock Hotel. The event reportedly set back Bonderman by $7 million, but staged far from the press hordes in New York, it generated only a few scattered press reports. With the LBO business on ice at the beginning of the new decade, Peterson and Schwartzman continued their quest to round out Blackstone's collection of businesses, bolstering the partner ranks with a string of high-profile hires. In addition to Henry Silverman on the buyout team, Schwartzman enticed David Batten, a seasoned capital markets executive, to join from First Boston in June 1990. The following year, Batten brought in Joseph E. Robert, Jr., who had overseen the disposal of $2.3 billion worth of distressed real estate for the Resolution Trust Corporation, the federal agency charged with salvaging as much value as possible from the carcasses of failed SNLs seized by the government. The inventory of troubled real estate, mortgage loans, and entire thrifts that the RTC was poised to auction off ran to tens of billions of dollars. Up and down Wall Street, people were salivating at the prospect of the RTC's liquidation sales, and Batten arranged to work with Robert on scooping up real estate at distressed prices. Robert didn't join the Blackstone partnership, preferring to stay an independent contractor. A second new business emerged almost unintentionally, a byproduct of the need to invest the $100 million Blackstone had received from NICO. Blackstone's abortive risk arbitrage fling in 1989 had eaten into the original hoard, but Schwartzman shuddered at the thought of putting the cash at risk in the turbulent markets. Still, the firm couldn't afford to leave the capital invested in low-paying certificates of deposit forever. Batten, who had been charged with managing the money, hit on a solution. That summer, he proposed that Blackstone divvy up the money and invest it with a half-dozen successful hedge funds, so named because they hedged their bets by deploying capital across an array of securities and currencies and could sell short when they thought the markets were headed down. The aim was to make money in down as well as up markets, and the best of the funds habitually had outstripped the stock market's performance. At the time, hedge funds were a small galaxy in the financial cosmos, but a handful of proven